This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
When George Dennis retired from his career as an American Airlines pilot, he wanted to do something more than just retire. His next mission came along when he happened to notice an old DC-3 airplane sitting in a field. Dennis couldn't resist temptation, and he put a down payment on his credit card to purchase the classic aircraft, and thus began a 17-year odyssey that entailed a meticulous restoration of the classic twin-engine aircraft with the assistance of literally thousands of volunteers, including employees at American Airlines who also volunteered their time to assist with a myriad of details, from airframe restoration to reupholstering the interior finishes. Originally built in Santa Monica, California back in 1936, the aircraft served as American Airlines flagship City of Detroit until the airline sold the craft in 1948. Today, the City of Detroit flagship remains in service, participating in air shows around the country, as well as special visits to American Airline hubs to share the experience of aviation's pioneering days with active duty pilots and flight attendants. Today, the City of Detroit is the world's oldest airworthy DC-3. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at the Shelbyville, Tennessee airport for a visit with George Dennis and his airborne compatriots, Dave Buffington, Lisa Butler, and her husband, Blake Butler. George Dennis.
I'm founder of the Flagship Detroit Foundation, and I found the airplane in the field back in 2004. It was my mission to try to do something after I retired. And instead of doing the traditional stuff of joining Lions Club or whatever, I just decided that I've always loved the DC-3. I flew the DC-3 while I was in college, and I thought it would be nice to take an airplane like that, representing the company I'm retiring from, and take it to air shows to show people, young and old, the history of early aviation.
Do you ever take kids up on the hops, on flights?
All the time.
Yeah.
Yep, and a lot of old people, too. We've had flight attendants that were in their 80s. We had pilots that were in their 80s that flew the DC-3, and we do a membership ride, so we have the very young and the very old.
The beauty of that aircraft today is that it's frozen in time. You all have gone to great lengths, livery, and detailing interior upholstery to make it as it was, right?
That's true. And that was done with the help of 1,000 volunteers everywhere, from volunteers that just came off the street to specialized people in maintenance on engines, on painting. And American Airlines was very supportive with letting their employees, their volunteers, do a lot of the work. But we have many, 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 many hours getting it just exactly the way it came out of the factory from Santa Monica in 1937. So it was in operation from 1937 until American Airlines sold it in 1948. And it was in passenger service the whole time it was there. It was never drafted in for the war during the Second World War.
How cool. And part of this aircraft's mission might not be primary, but it's flying, like you said, to SFO to share this aircraft literally with American Airlines employees.
Right. Well, that's true. Part of the payback, American Airlines contracted us to do employee days. So we did employee days at major hubs for American Airlines, including San Francisco and Chicago and Dallas and Miami and New York. And we would fly it there for their employee days, membership rides along with that.
So all three of you were American Airlines pilots, correct?
No, two of us here, but the majority of when we first started were American Airlines pilot. Blake and I, Blake Butler, and I have been friends for 30-some years, and we've flown little airplanes our whole life, and he was interested in DC-3, and thank God we got him because he's helped out us a lot.
My name is Dave Buffington, and I've been with the organization almost from the beginning. I started with them in 2005, right after I've retired.
So you flew 737, 727, 747?
Well, I started out on the 727 and basically flew that most of my career. Ended up on the 777 flying Tokyo, but most of my career was spent on the 727. I flew the Super 80 for a while also.
So when you started out flying 727s and then you moved into the 777, quite a different world, right, between those two aircraft?
There was a huge transition there. Mm-hmm. It went from non-automated to fully automated. It was an interesting transition. I loved both airplanes for totally different reasons, but they were both great airplanes to fly.
Can you land a 777 hands-off?
Oh, absolutely. It will do a marvelous job all by itself.
It has its own hands, three autopilots.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So both of you guys, you had your career, left seat, right seat, flying commercial jets. Now you're flying radial engine DC-3.
Now that was a transition.
Yeah, going back to the beginning. Translate that to us, that experience, and what the epiphanous moments were for you guys going back in time.
Well, I've always loved history. I've always loved aviation history. This brought it front and center for me, and I think that the transition was interesting, but all airplanes are fun to fly. Some are more fun to fly than others.
But and there must be some like time travel moments for you guys. You're sitting right seat, left seat, where some guy in 1938 was flying the state-of-the-art aircraft. You know,
yes,
what?
Tell it
us
was.
About, tell
it
us about
was.
Some of those moments.
And I guess that's just history, where you can fly state-of-the-art and then 10, 15 years later, it isn't anymore. But it's still an airplane. It has its own characteristics, and it has each airplane has its desirable points and the undesirable points. The DC-3 is a very fun airplane to fly.
For a moment, step back in time, flying that these guys that flew the DC-3 in the 30s and what navigational aids they had and altitude and pressurization.
Well, Ernie Gann can say that a whole lot better than I can. He actually flew the airplane back in those days, and he is a master at letting the world know what it was like in those days to fly the airplane.
I knew Ernie Gann. I live 4 miles from his farm, and he would practice over my farm. It was like, wow, what a show.
We've all learned quite a bit from Ernie. I mean, reading his books. You know, I had some experience in DC-3 while going through college, but the more I read on this, it just brought back the moments that those guys, what they did back in the 30s, leaving out of Detroit and flying to Washington, D.C. in a snowstorm with no radar. In our airplanes, in the 777, you know, we climb up to 41,000 feet going to Tokyo or Hong Kong. And in this airplane, the average altitude was 5,000 or 7,000 feet, just depending. So
you were talking about that pilot's logbook that you were reading and his average altitude.
Yes, we had the wonderful time meeting a fellow that was an original American Airlines pilot and stopping at Longmont. It's a different story. We were going from Longmont to Cheyenne, and the controller said there's a level 5 thunderstorm. You need to circle or go to holding. And a friend of mine said, well, I've got a nephew in Longmont. So we flew, like we did a lot, we flew around the town at 500 feet, and that way we can bring people to the airport, and when we land, maybe sell a hat or a T-shirt. And this little guy come walking up to me, and he said, I flew this airplane. And we've had, over the years, we've had a bunch of C-47 pilots that flew the hump. And I said, oh, you flew the C-47? He said, no, I flew this damn airplane, and here's my logbook.
Wow.
And he pulled out all the logbooks, and he put the routing that they did, the date, the altitude they flew, and then in his logbook, I think I shared with you, he flew Eleanor Roosevelt several times, and she signed his logbook. So it was very interesting.
How cool. And a little bit more, again, the end of your career, you're going from altitude 35 to 40,000 feet to now flying at what, 1,000 feet?
Well, 4,000? Well, where we're going.
Yeah. But you were talking about that trip across West Texas.
there's no FAA guys here. Anyway, we flew a couple. during our trip from Salt Lake going out to west, flying over the mountains, there's no air traffic control around there. So we flew 500 feet over the hills and the mountains, and it was just a beautiful flight. And then coming back on West Texas, we were following a train at 500 feet, and we all waved at them.
And they're waving back.
Yeah. But I think more interesting is Blake, he's never flown anything really big. Mm-hmm. A lot of us flew for the airlines, and I'll let him explain how he changes from being a Bonanza pilot to a DC-3 pilot.
Well, I don't know that it's very interesting. I've always been fascinated from flying ever since a very young age. Mm-hmm. My life didn't take me to the airlines. I was a engineer for a utility company, retired from there. But yes, I flew Piper Cubs and Beach Bonanzas and through George, Twin Bonanzas and Queen Airs and 185 Cessnas on amphib floats and whatever we had to fly at the time.
Tell us about the transition, rudder paddle, and even turning that aircraft.
The DC-3 is different to fly, in my opinion, no matter what you came from. I love the mechanics. I love the everything is manual. Everything is pressure of your own hand or foot to move the control surfaces. So your pressures can be very hard, especially if
physically
hard. When I first started flying the DC-3, we'd do 2 or 3 crosswind landings, and the next day your upper leg was burning. You said, what's wrong with my leg? Oh, I've been pushing the rudder pedal. So it is physically demanding. It's an airplane that will get your attention if you don't pay attention to what you're doing.
Is it forgiving?
It's an easy plane to fly. I don't know if forgiving would be the right word. You have to pay attention. And it's interesting to watch people with much more experience than I fly the DC-3 for the first time. They think they're just going to walk in and jump in this little airplane and go fly. And then you watch it eat their lunch, and you chuckle in the back. And they realize what's going on. They become very good pilots. Mm-hmm. But, yes, you have to pay attention to flying the DC-3.
Why don't you talk to them about the engineering difference from that you, in your perspective, of how well this thing was the engines were made and the airplane was made in 1936 by basically people with slide rules.
This airplane was so far ahead of its time technologically. One thing I enjoy looking is how over-engineered it is. For example, the rivet spacing. This airplane has almost 1 million rivets. The rivets are practically right next to each other. Well, why? They weren't sure how close they needed to put the rivets, so let's just make sure they're plenty close. So structurally, this is really one of the first modern all-metal airplanes, and it is all-metal, save the control surfaces. They're fabric-covered, as were most of the fighters in World War II. The engines, to me, are phenomenal. You think this engine's 9 cylinders, 1,820 cubic inches, is supercharged. This engine will put out 1,200 horsepower in 1936, and it's lightweight, and it doesn't come apart. It's very reliable. To me, that's just astonishing that in that day and age, you could have such a robust, powerful engine. And the engines are what made the airplanes. As engine technology advanced, airplanes advanced. So this was the most advanced airplane in the world for 10 years or more.
And to this day, is still an operative, functional workhorse.
We plan to take off in the morning at 7 o'clock, mm-hmm. head into Dayton, Ohio, for about a 2-hour and 25-minute flight for a big air show. We still fly all over the country.
And it's still an economically viable freighter, correct, around the world?
Yes, but they're getting leaner every year. They're, different airplanes are taking their place, but especially down south, there's plenty of DC-3s flying freight. And I think I have a friend of mine in Miami that has a freight outfit that he runs to the Bahamas twice a week. He takes over canned food and he brings back fruit and vegetables from the Bahamas. So, yes, they're still flying around.
And the age, still airworthy aircraft, is amazing. How old in years is this aircraft?
In years, it's 84 years old and still operating. We still have to operate under the FAA conditions, and we have to have inspections twice a year,
sure.
And we have to have pilot training. And our flight attendant, Lisa Butler here, we still have to have a flight attendant when we take people up for membership rides, and she gives a little briefing.
Hi, I'm Lisa Butler. I serve as a volunteer stewardess aboard the flagship Detroit. I do not meet the past requirements of being a stewardess, which you had to be in your 20s and single and a registered nurse, but I do volunteer in that position now.
Did you have a career in aviation?
I did not have a career in aviation. I'm a retired educator. I have family history in aviation as private pilots and became interested in the DC-3 back in 2014 with my now husband as a Captain Blake Butler.
Cool. And for you, again, it must be humbling to fly and realize how your grandma or people flew every day.
It is very humbling. As we sit aboard the DC-3, I actually have viewed pictures of my grandparents that traveled across country in very similar situation. So it's kind of nice to make that connection. Eleanor Roosevelt was a regular passenger aboard the flagship Detroit. So to know that you are actually seated in a seat where a first lady frequently traveled is exhilarating.
And we were talking earlier, there was no such thing as Air Force One. No. So by default, aircraft like that functioned as Air Force One for presidents and their families.
And their families, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything you guys want to add and share? Parting thoughts?
My name is Blake Butler. I'm a volunteer captain on the flagship Detroit. It is very humbling to get to fly a piece of history. It's an unbelievable responsibility every time you get behind the wheel. I think it's my job to make sure this airplane lands back on this runway safely, not just for the people on board, but for the history that we're flying. It's a very humbling experience.
I guess my parting thought is that I am humbled also, but I'm humbled not only because of the airplane and the history, but I'm humbled with all the volunteers that put this thing together. When I went and looked at that airplane in 2004 at a field in Bridgewater, Virginia, and I made a deal, and I put the down payment on my Visa card and had to explain to my wife, and everybody came to my rescue, and we formed this nonprofit organization, and we've been in business now 17 years, and we couldn't have done any of it without these volunteers.
Very good. And this is Homeport where we are right now?
Yes, during the show, show season, it's here in Shelbyville. In the wintertime, it's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is American Airlines allows us to stay in the hangar under the wing of a 777 where
nice.
We can do volunteer maintenance.
How cool. That'd be a neat picture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the most rewarding things that this whole process has done for me is when we go to an air show to see how many people are really interested in the airplane. It's an old airplane. We're there with sometimes lots of other old airplanes, but we always have a huge crowd and a long line waiting for people to get in to see the airplane. It's just that reward that keeps me coming back, along with flying the airplane also. My name is Dave Buffington. I've been with the organization since 2005.
Thank you so much. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Shelbyville. We'll see you here.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.